Welcome, everyone, to episode 11 of the Live Vegan Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Leahy, and we are joined once again by our co-host, Ben Loa. What's up, Ben?
Hey, everybody. I just want to give you a heads up. I am right now doing the fast for Animals First on the 2nd. So if I start becoming incoherent or saying some crazy things, I'm just going to blame my stomach.
That's a very ambitious New Year's resolution. You know, you have to beat AJ Garcia's 9-day fast. That's where the bar is set.
Yeah, no. This is one day is hard enough for me. I'm at about 22 hours right now. So,
well, great. Good for you.
Yeah, it's just this cool new initiative with Animals First on the 2nd. So if anybody's interested, look it up. And there's some awareness that goes along with it. So,
awesome. Well, very excited for today's episode. We have a hero in my books. He is the very famous Paul Shapiro from the Humane Society of the United States. He is the vice president of policy there and an inductee in the Animal Rights Hall of Fame. He is the author of the brand new book, Clean Meat, which is being released today, January 2nd, 2018. And my copy is on the way. I haven't received it yet, but I can't wait to read it. So we'll definitely talk about his book. But first, we'll talk a little bit about Paul's background and how he became such a superstar for animals. He went vegan at age 13, which is incredible, and he's worked his entire adult life fighting for animals. At age 15, he founded Compassion Over Killing, which is still a very effective animal rights organization. I call him the Doogie Howser of the animal rights movement. How did he do all this at such a young age? In 2005, he moved to the HSUS, where he's worked on dozens of legal campaigns to improve conditions for animals on factory farms and ban the most horrific practices within the industry. So in this podcast, we like to give listeners tips on how they can do more to save animals. So we hope our conversation will provide them with some very sage advice on where their efforts can be most effective. And we will all hopefully learn about a very exciting revolutionary technology, which is going to be, we hope, the saving grace for billions of animals being raised for food. So welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Kevin and Ben, what an honor to be with you. It's very kind words that you are expressing. And Ben, let me say, In 1998, I decided to fast as well, although I didn't do it for a noble reason like you are. I am... to be honest with you, I did it just because I thought it was like a interesting, healthy thing to do. I had read this book by Joel Fuhrman called Fasting and Eating for Health. And in short, I thought, I'll try to go for 7 days with eating nothing at all and just consuming water. And it was difficult. I mean, my girlfriend at the time and my family all thought I was crazy. But it was an interesting experience, and I did do it. I had only water for 7 days, and I lost 14 pounds. It was a really effective way to lose weight. Not that I wanted to lose weight, but I know the pangs of hunger that you're enduring right now. So my hat's off to you, Ben.
Yeah, well, I'm on 22 hours, so you're making me feel bad that you went 7 days, and I can barely do this.
let me tell you a tip, actually. Your body realizes that it's not eating after about a day or so, and so you really stop being hungry. I found more difficult than the hunger pangs was like really the social disruption, that your day is segmented into these meals, and you eat when at these times, or you have social experiences with your friends or your family about eating with them. And that was more difficult to me, not having those breaks in the day, than the actual non-consumption of food.
Oh, all right. Well, thanks for the tip.
Yeah.
Okay. Man. So I want to. Okay, we'll get into Clean Meat. We'll get into the Humane Society of the United States. But I want to talk to you at how someone at 13 becomes aware enough that to become vegan. I mean, I personally became vegetarian when I was 15. There was nobody else my age that was vegetarian. Nobody in my high school. I didn't even know about, you know, the eggs and dairy industry to think, oh, that's horrible. You know, I just figured, man, no one's dying. It's not a big deal. So how at 13 did you suddenly become this, have this awareness, or was it more gradual, or what? How did this happen?
It's very nice of you to suggest there was like some, you know, revelation that I had, but in reality, it was far less dramatic than that. I mean, what happened was that a friend of mine had a videotape, like an actual VHS videotape. And for younger listeners who won't know what that is, it's a rectangular piece of plastic with some film in it that you put into a big machine called a VCR. And, you know, it shows video. So this is way before the YouTube era. And in short, he had this video of animals on factory farms and fur farms and slaughterhouses and laboratories and circuses. And he showed it to me, and he didn't show it to me as a means of outreach. It's not like he was some animal sympathizer. He just thought it was like a crazy thing. He's like, dude, you got to see this. And he showed it to me. And all I kept thinking as I was watching it were, you know, what if those were my dogs? Well, those are my dogs inside those cages, or being hung upside down and having their throats slit open. And I really just kept thinking, I wouldn't want that to happen to my dog, so why would I want it to happen to any animal? Now, I knew about vegetarianism. I knew that was a thing. And so I thought, you know, I should do that. I should become a vegetarian. I had never heard of vegan or veganism, anything like that. And so there was no internet back then. And so I wrote to various animal protection groups and asked them to send me, like by snail mail, although it was just mail back then, anything they had about vegetarianism. And I got back this stuff about what I thought were vegans. I'm like, what are these vegans? They don't eat eggs or dairy. And so I started reading about the egg and the dairy industries, and I thought, you know, that's a real shame. But I mean, I thought of it kind of like holding your breath. Like, you know, you can go for a little while without holding your breath, but if you do it too long, you die. Or take fasting. You can fast for some time, but if you do it too long, you'll die. I thought that being one of these so-called vegans would be like that, that maybe you could go for some time, maybe weeks, maybe even months, without eating any animal products, but then you would die. So I started volunteering for these animal groups within weeks, and I met these people who I learned were called vegans, not vegans. I was like, wow. And they started telling me that, you know, many of them have been doing it for years, like years. Wow. And so I'm looking at them, trying to determine, like, is their skin pale? Do they look sickly? I'm trying to, you know, figure any hole in the argument here. And one of them told me, he's telling me about Carl Lewis. Now, people of a certain age will remember Carl Lewis, but younger people will think Carl Lewis was like the Michael Phelps or the Usain Bolt of the Olympics back then. In other words, he was like the main name in Olympics, like the best in his sport, which it was track. And I worshipped Carl Lewis. I mean, he was like a god to me. And they told me he was vegan. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, Carl Lewis is a vegan? And yeah, this dude was the epitome of health and fitness. And so that was when I was like, all right, if it seems like it's good for animals and it seems like it's good for my body, I'm going to do it. So that's really what led me to do it. It was no, you know, road to Damascus type revelation as much as it was just having the good fortune of meeting other vegans who could welcome me in a loving and embracing way, rather than, you know, treating me like an outsider.
Well, I'll definitely say you were the most in shape vegan I've ever met in real life as of 2012. That
oh,
you were,
that's nice
you,
of you.
You were my Carl Lewis when I first met you.
No. If you want to see a really cool dude, look up Frank Medrano. He's a vegan calisthenics expert, and it is. I mean, he is truly an athlete unto a league of his own. So check out Frank Medrano. I'm always impressed. I follow him on Instagram, and it's like, I just think, I wish I could look like him.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely check him out. So in 2005, you moved to the Humane Society of the United States. Why did you leave Compassion Over Killing after having spent so many years there and after having founded it? And why do you think your efforts were better fit at the Humane Society?
Well, I'm happy to talk about that. And there's, you know, some evolution in my thinking as of late as well on this. So to answer your question shortly, though, I had founded Compassion Over Killing in 1995. And in 2004, 9 years later, Wayne Pacelli became president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. Wayne was a longtime animal advocate, a personal friend, and someone who all of us were in shock had been elected to the presidency of the Humane Society, because for so long there had been this perception that the Humane Society was only concerned about dogs and cats, which really wasn't true, but that was the perception that we had at the time. Well, Wayne was a longtime animal advocate, a vegan, and someone who really cared about farm animals. And so here we were, these young kids, seeing this guy who we perceived really as, you know, like one of us, running the Humane Society, which is the largest animal protection organization on Earth, and still is. And so when Wayne assumed the presidency, a few months later, he asked those of us at Compassion Over Killing if we would come over to start a farm animal protection campaign there, which the organization hadn't previously had. And in short, we said yes and came over. And the reason was because we knew that in order to combat a multi-billion-dollar industry like the factory farming industry, we had to have resources behind us. It's the difference between being in a swift boat or being in a battleship. And admittedly, compared to the interests that want to harm animals, HSUS is very small. But compared to most other animal groups, HSUS is very big. And it has the most sophisticated, most influential political operation of any animal protection group, with a large presence in the U.S. Capitol and in nearly all 50 state legislatures as well. And so that was attractive to us, to try to make animal protection a political movement, not just a cultural conflict, not just trying to change individual by individual, but actually create new policies, both through the legislatures, through the courts, through the ballot boxes, and so on, that would positively impact the lives of animals. 13 years later, now we have a revolution in food technology that is really dramatically driving new changes in the way that people will be eating in the future. So, you know, you look at the evolution of plant-based meats in that time, especially plant-based milks, and now with clean meats, or growing real meat from animal cells as opposed to animal slaughter. And I think that these type of food technologies might end up doing even more good for animals than what has come before. It's kind of like how Henry Ford helped liberate horses from labor in our streets, even though his intent was not to do animal advocacy. He actually accomplished more for horses than animal advocates were doing at the time. And so I personally have had an evolution in my own thinking on these issues. And with the release of my new book, Clean Meat, I am going to be shifting my role to be focused a lot more on the food technology side. And so I'll be promoting this book because I think it's an important book, the first book looking at this movement to grow real animal products without animals. And so I am going to be leaving my role as an employee of HSUS, and I will be doing some consulting work, but I'm especially looking forward to moving into the food technology realm, both through the promotional aspect in this book and perhaps even through my own career, but that's still yet to be seen.
Okay, so food technology, we definitely want to talk about. I just want to get your view on something first. So I figured you were the right person to ask. So in our movement, there are there's a lot of debate about, you know, welfarism, abolitionism, and whatnot. Personally, I was someone that, you know, for a while thought, you know, abolitionism is the only way to go. That's all we can do. And anything else just isn't enough. Now I'm not arrogant enough to believe that I have all the answers and I know better than everyone else. But HSUS does focus a lot on the treatment of non-humans. Now, like you said, it's all non-humans. It's not just, you know, cats and dogs. But why should we be concerned about, you know, the treatment of these beings if, you know, if they are still being exploited, if they are still being killed? Why is that still important to this movement?
Well, for a lot of reasons, for the same reason why Amnesty International works to get better conditions for political prisoners. Amnesty International doesn't want these people imprisoned at all, but they're still working to get them access to medical treatment or being able to get mail from their families. It's the same reason why opponents of the death penalty will do things to, for example, to try to ban the electric chair, even though they would prefer for there to be no death penalty at all. The fact of the matter is that billions and billions of animals are going to be raised and killed for some time to come. Even the most wildly optimistic thoughts about these issues would say tens, if not hundreds of billions of animals are going to be raised and killed for food. There's no way to spare that from happening. And that's, you know, just in a matter of each year. And those animals matter. They're not abstract statistics. They are real animals whose lives matter. And frankly, they're doomed. They are going to be raised. They are going to be killed. And so I want to make sure that those animals are treated as well as possible, or perhaps as least miserably as possible while they're here. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't also be working toward a day when we don't view animals as mere commodities. Of course, we should. But for those who would argue that reducing the suffering of animals actually makes them worse off, and that's the argument. And the argument of so-called abolitionists is that reducing the suffering of animals is bad for them because it makes people more likely to eat them. If that's true, and there's not really much evidence for it, but if it is true, then you would want animals to be worse off. If making animals better off makes people less likely to stop eating them, you would want animals to be worse off. And the reality is, sadly, most people are not making their food purchasing decisions based on the treatment of animals. I mean, if they did, you wouldn't see, for example, the cruelest products like chicken and eggs being among the most popular products. Most people just don't take that into consideration. You know, the arguments for being vegan are very compelling. People talk about ethics or the environment or health, whereas ethics, environment, and health are not really what drive most food decisions in people's mind. It's price, taste, and convenience. So there may be a small portion of the population that is making its decisions based on that, but most people are just going based on price, taste, and convenience. And since that's true, I think it's important that animals have the protections that people at least agree with. People may not agree that animals ought not be slaughtered, but most people would agree that they ought not be tortured their whole lives in tiny cages where they can barely move an inch their whole lives. And so even though animals have very little legal protection, to the extent that the public actually wants them to have protection, I think we should be willing to gain them those incremental gains and recognize that progress begets progress. You never go from A to Z without going through 24 letters, other letters first. You have to go step by step. And so I view it just as a long run, not a sprint, not a marathon, but a relay race that will really last our whole lives. And the baton is in our hands now. We want to run as fast and hard as we can throughout our lives, but get them as much protection as we can. And hopefully that will lead to more in the future as well.
Well said. I really like this track and field theme we're going with here.
Inadvertent, but I'll try to keep it up.
So the next baton pass would be clean meat, right? And so what is it, for those who don't know, how soon will it be commercially available, and why did you write an entire book about it, and why are you so personally excited about this new technology?
Well, everything you're saying makes sense. So first off, just for those who aren't aware, clean meat is not an alternative to meat. It's not like Beyond Meat or The Impossible Burger or Tofurky, all companies that are fantastic and that I love. But clean meat is not an alternative to meat. It's actual meat. It is grown from animal cells rather than animal slaughter. So, for example, think about taking a sesame seed-sized biopsy of muscle tissue from an animal. Again, the size of a sesame seed. From the cells in that tiny little biopsy, you can grow literally tons of meat. Literally tons and tons of meat. And you have the opportunity, therefore, to have meat that never involved the slaughter of an animal, that didn't involve factory farming, that involved far fewer resources to produce it than would have been needed to produce similar numbers of animals to provide that type of meat. So it's much better for the environment, which is why it's called clean meat, like clean energy. It's certainly better for animals, and it's better for food safety too. It's just literally cleaner because you don't have intestinal pathogens like E. coli and Salmonella because you're not growing intestines at all. You're just growing muscle. So that's what clean meat is. Now, the reason why so many people, myself included, are so enthusiastic about it is because it offers the opportunity for meat eaters to continue eating real meat without harming animals. And there's so many people who just profess that they are wedded to what they would perceive as the so-called real thing. I mean, let's not delude ourselves. Plant-based meats, as awesome and as popular as they are still less than 1% of the meat market. More than 99% of meat that is sold is animal-based meat. Less than 1% is plant-based. The rest of it is animal. And so to the extent, and I think that'll change. I think plant-based meats are really going to take off because of innovative companies. But at the same time, even if we could get plant-based meats to 10% of the market, which is where plant-based milks are right now in the U.S., you still have 90% animal-based meat, which means billions and billions and billions of animals being subjected to really unimaginable horrors. And so we need some alternative solution. And it's kind of like fossil fuels, that fossil fuels are so problematic that you want more than one alternative. You don't want just wind or just solar or just geothermal. You want a whole array of options to try to compete with fossil fuels. Factory farming is the same. It is so bad. It's so terrible for the planet and for animals that you want numerous alternatives. You want plant-based meats. You want whole foods, plant-based diets. You want clean meats and maybe even something else that we don't even know about yet. But you want a whole variety of alternatives that can help address this problem. And so I have basically come to the conclusion myself that both the plant-based and the clean meat space offers such potential for animals, such huge gains possibly for animals, and there's so few people working on it that it might make sense for me to focus more and more of my attention on that. And that's why I wrote this book, to tell the story of these early pioneers who are creating this nascent field of what's called cellular agriculture, and to help the public understand the promise that these companies, these small startups hold, and how they could totally revolutionize not only the way that we produce food, but revolutionize our treatment of animals as well.
All right, can you maybe in a simple way, without getting too scientific on it, take us kind of through the process? Like, how does this work? What I understand is there still is, you need an animal to use, and I know a lot of hardcore vegans are saying that's still exploitation, so that's still not okay. But what is the process like? Okay, you get a cow, comes into a room, and then what? How does this happen? How does it all of a sudden end up in a in a petri dish, and then it's on the shelf?
Sure. Well, to be clear, clean meat is not necessarily marketed. It will not be marketed toward vegans. The goal is not to displace plant-based foods from the market, it is to displace animal-based meat. And meat, whether vegans eat it or not really doesn't matter. It's designed for people who are going to KFC, not for people who are going to Veggie Grill. But here's the answer to the question. So imagine that you take that tiny little biopsy, a minuscule little biopsy, and in that sesame seed-sized sample of tissue, there are millions of cells. These are cells whose sole career path is to become muscle tissue. That's all they're ever going to do, is to become muscle tissue. You can take those cells and put them in a cultivator that makes them think that they are still inside of the animal's body. And because they think they're still inside the animal's body, they do what they do, which is produce actual muscle tissue. So they are producing the same type of muscle tissue outside of the animal's body as they would be were they inside of the animal's body. But because when you're raising an animal, the animal has so many caloric needs that are unrelated to muscle growth. Think about it. Intestines, eyeballs, hooves, skin, horns, all the reasons they use energy that does not go into meat production. You can just use the energy only needed to produce that actual animal meat. So that is a big resource efficiency advantage for them. And in fact, the reason why there was ever even any academic exploration of this was because NASA wanted to fund research into whether long-term astronauts would be able to grow their own meat. So, of course, if you are going to eat meat in space, you're not going to be bringing Noah's Ark in tow. You are going to have to grow your own meat there. So that's how it's done. Now, there are other clean animal products that do not involve even initial animal starter cells. So, for example, there are companies now like Perfect Day and Clara Foods and Geltor and Modern Meadow that are making egg whites and milk and gelatin and leather without even using animal cells at all. They are synthesizing the proteins via really interesting microbial fermentation processes. And they are creating real milk with whey and casein, like the actual dairy proteins, without any animal starter cells at all. But for the meat, you still do need the starter cells.
Now, does the animal have to be alive, or can it be taken after the animal has died of old age, for example?
Either way, there would be no difference to an animal who has recently died or an animal who is still alive. There would be no difference at all.
Okay. And what does it taste like? I know you said that when you tried it for the first time, there were more people who, or fewer people who had been to space?
Yeah, at the time, the first time I ate queen meat was in 2014. And it's true, at that time, more people had been into space than had ever eaten meat that had been grown outside of an animal. And I've eaten it now numerous times, from queen beef, duck, fish, chorizo, liver, yogurt even. All of these are real animal products that were grown without any animals. And so I don't have an ethical quandary about it. It's not saying that I would really want to incorporate these foods into my diet on a regular basis, because I've been a vegan since 1993. I don't really crave to have animal products in my diet. But I thought, for the purpose of writing the book, it would be useful to have done it. And so I was happy to do it. It was a little bit conflicted at first, but only for aesthetic reasons, not really for ethical reasons. But to answer your question, I mean, it tastes like meat because it is meat. It's not like when you have a Beyond Burger and you're thinking to yourself, hey, does this taste like an actual hamburger? Well, this is actual meat. So it is a, it's not an alternative. It really is the so-called real thing.
Now, you said before that the three main factors for people's decisions are cost, convenience, and taste. Now, we just talked about the taste, and the taste is going to be exactly the same. What is this, you know, when this does hit the market, and I'm hearing that this could happen really soon, what's the cost going to be like compared to, you know, the animal flesh industry? Because I know it's not going to be subsidized like they are, or maybe it is. I assume it's not. And how, you know, is this something that you think will just be all of a sudden it'll be in every grocery store, or is it going to be, you know, just little health food stores you got to find it in?
Well, it's unlikely to be in health food stores, because I think the key target demographic for this are not the folks who are going to small health food stores. The goal was for this to displace conventional commodity meat, which is hard because that's the cheapest meat to displace. John Mackey, though, the CEO of Whole Foods, did announce, pretty cool, if you go to the website cleanmeat.com, you can see his commentary on this, but he said that right now the meat that is sold in Whole Foods is rated from 1 through 5+ on an animal welfare scale, with 5+ being the highest animal welfare score. And he said that when clean meat hits the market, he wants to put it in their meat case and label it an animal welfare rating of 10 to show that no animal suffered in any way to produce this meat. Now, when will it be available? It really depends on how you define it, because some of these products, like gelatin or collagen, have already been commercialized by a company called Geltor. Others, though, like dairy proteins and some egg white proteins, you're probably looking at within the next year or so before those hits the market in a limited way. I do think that there will be some clean meat sales in very limited quantities in the next year or so. But in terms of actually having it on grocery store shelves where you could go and buy it, you're probably looking at still a few years away.
Oh, I was excited. I thought it was going to be in 2018. I guess we have to wait.
I believe there will be sales of these products in 2018, but I think it'll be on a pretty limited basis. The problem is that these companies were all founded pretty much, nearly all of them were founded within the last couple of years. And so they're still really in the R&D phase, trying to figure out how to bring the cost down. The first clean hamburger ever produced in 2013 had a price tag of over $300,000, the most expensive burger ever in world history. Now they've brought that cost way down, more than 80% down just in 4 years. Now, you know, you can have meatballs, Queen meatballs, for a comparative bargain of only $1,200 a meatball. So, you know, you're still a little bit above the price that most people want when they go to a nice Italian restaurant, but you can see the trajectory. And, you know, I was reading recently, pretty interestingly, that if 10 years ago you had wanted all of the photo editing features that are available in Instagram, it would have cost you more than $2 million for that photo lab. Now, it's just a free download. You know, the first iPhone 10 years ago, which came out 10 years ago, the very first iPhone would cost more than a couple billion dollars to create. And now a lot of us are walking around with them in our pockets. So you can see the trajectory on some of these technological advancements, that the price does come down. And that doesn't mean it necessarily will, but it can. And in this space, with more investment from venture capitalists and other private equity funds, perhaps, and investors, you can see how they can get the amount of funding that they need in order to bring the prices down to hopefully a cost competitive level. Because when this becomes cost competitive, I think that's when you're going to see real changes in the meat market.
Awesome.
So let's, if you could just maybe just, I want to get your thoughts on something a lot of the critics will say about the clean meat is, I can't eat that. I wouldn't eat that. That's just unnatural. And, which the term natural to me is one of my pet peeves. It's one of my least favorite words on the planet. But what, how would you, I don't want to get into it, but it's just what is natural. It's just, it's a human made concept.
Murder
but,
is natural.
So yeah, but what do you say point. When somebody tells you that? It's like, I can't eat, I don't want my meat grown out of a lab. That's not natural.
Well, a couple things. The first is, then don't eat it. If you don't want to eat it, then don't. You know, again, it's not necessarily for vegans, but vegans should welcome it, because vegans want to see animals spared from factory farms and slaughter plants, and clean meat seems to have an enormous potential to achieve that goal. That doesn't mean that vegans
that think it's not natural.
Well, I would suggest a couple things. So first, as you pointed out, you know, nearly nothing that we eat is natural. Us Skyping right now is not natural. Air conditioning and heat isn't natural. Anesthesia isn't natural. The fruits that we eat today aren't just natural. They are produced through all types of scientific technologies that make them available to us. And you look at what bananas looked like before we domesticated them. They were much smaller. They had gigantic seeds in them. They were barely edible. The same thing with corn and so many other things. Or, you know, when somebody eats a seedless watermelon, are they thinking to themselves, oh, this is unnatural, and without even thinking, well, why do you think it is seedless? You think that just happens in nature? Obviously not. But let me tell you a quick story. So I'm always baffled when people accept all types of unnatural things in their lives. But then when it comes to this issue, something that really could do more good on Earth than almost any other technology, there's all of a sudden some concern. So let me put it to you this way. In the 19th century, there was a huge natural ice industry. The large fortunes were made from harvesting big blocks of ice from northern lakes and shipping it around the world. Well, enter the advent of industrial refrigeration, and all of a sudden you had a way to produce ice just by cooling the local water right in front of you down. And the natural ice industry was livid over this technological innovation. They completely derided this new, what they called, artificial ice industry. And they warned people, this ice is not natural. It's risky. You don't know if you might get sick from it. This isn't the way that nature or God intended. And the irony at the time was that actually the so-called artificial ice was much safer than the natural ice, because natural ice came from waters that might have been polluted. They were using horses to cut the ice out of the river, out of the lakes, which meant, of course, the horses are going to the bathroom right in the lake, whereas artificial ice was being cooled down from waters that have been boiled or otherwise filtered, and so was therefore much safer to put in your drink. So, and now you fast forward another century or plus, and all of us have artificial ice makers in our homes. We call them freezers, and we hardly think there's anything unnatural about it at all. In fact, most of us wouldn't even consider living without one. So I'm not so sure that just because something seems novel to us at the time, it doesn't mean that our descendants are going to view it that way. So much of what we have just isn't natural at all. But that doesn't mean it's bad. We're glad to have heat in the winter. We're glad to have air conditioning in the summer. We're glad to have modern medicine and antibiotics. And we should be glad for technologies that can lighten our footprint on the planet. Clean meat is, according to a life cycle analysis that was done by an Oxford University researcher, compared to conventional beef, clean beef would have 99% less land use, would have up to 90% fewer greenhouse gas emissions, more than 90% less water use. It's hard to ignore these type of numbers, even if they're not right. Early life cycle analyses often are speculative, but even if they're anywhere close to being right, it's hard to ignore these kind of numbers. And so I would suggest that when people think about novelty of items, they think about those past examples like ice, and then think about the way that their meat gets to them today. Because most people eat meat in spite of how it's produced, not because of how it is produced. And when they stop to pause and think about just how unnatural and inhumane and unsustainable current meat production is, clean meat or plant-based meats even seem a far more naturally preferable option.
Wow. I am rethinking the ice cubes in my iced tea now.
Artificial ice.
That's right. Artificial ice. Listen, I know we're almost out of time, so I wanted to ask you to paint the picture of the future for us with, as you see it, as you see this very important technology coming into view, do you see, I know they've compared them to beer breweries. We're going to have meat breweries mm-hmm. everywhere, like in the back of a restaurant, you'll be able to brew your own meat and then it'll be served on your plate and they'll say it's locally brewed right here. Like, how do you see the future and how long will it take us to get there?
Well, it's possible that that type of a future could occur, and I think the amount of time that it takes is dependent on how much money is invested in these technologies. What's needed is not millions of dollars, it's tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to create this type of an industry at a commercial level that's cost competitive. And so your guess is as good as mine as to when someone will put up that kind of money for these companies. But I don't think it's that impossible to imagine meat breweries that brew their own artisanal local meats. Maybe you would call them not breweries, but carneries, maybe. That doesn't seem that impossible to me. But time will tell. It's also possible that this won't work. There's a lot of potential obstacles that could stand in the way of this industry, from government regulations, consumer acceptance issues, and so on. But I'm optimistic that these companies will succeed because of a variety of reasons, not the least of which is they have many extremely dedicated people working in them, seeking to make this type of future a reality, where our meat comes not from slaughterhouses, not from factory farms, but rather from humane, sustainable sources that didn't involve harming animals.
Well, I think when there's people like Bill Gates and Richard Branson and even, you know, Cargill Meats, which is one of the biggest, you know, meat companies, when they're investing in this, then you gotta be optimistic that they see something, that this is going somewhere. This is going to make some progress for sure.
Amen. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Okay, so before we wrap up, the book launched today. Where can people get this?
Anywhere that sells books, but it would be easiest just to go to cleanmeat.com. Again, cleanmeat.com, and check it out. You can see what others are saying about the book. You can watch a short book trailer. You can see all the places that are selling it, which is everywhere that sells books. And you can also email me. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear what you have to say about it, if you read it especially. And if you like it, then go leave a nice Amazon review. If you don't like it, then feel free just to shut up.
That's well said. And you will also be in Toronto on January 5th, Friday, right, to give a speech about your book?
I can't wait. We're going to be at the University of Toronto Rotman School of Business Management, and it's going to be a great time. I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope that this podcast comes out before then and that people will come to it.
Absolutely. We'll load it up tonight. Well, thank you, right, Paul. We look forward to reading your book. Again, cleanmeat.com. If anyone has any questions, you can go to that website and check out the book. Paul, please keep being a superstar. I'm so excited for what you will do in the future. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Kevin, thanks so much. It's great to be with you. Ben, good luck with the fast. I look forward to hearing the results of it. And I hope that I will see you both in Toronto.
Excellent. Thank you, Paul.
All right, guys. Paul, take care.
And we're back. What'd you think, Ben? What an incredible interview, huh?
Yeah, that was a lot to take in. That was a lot to learn. It kind of just blew by when you said we were almost done. I had no idea. I had a lot more questions. I wanted to get into talking about the competitiveness in the business side of it, because from what I understand, there's multiple different companies and they're kind of on this race to be the first one to get it out. It's like the modern space race. And I wanted to chat with him about that too. And there's so much to get into on this topic.
Yeah, you're right. There's definitely a lot. And I believe in his book, he talks about exactly what you just mentioned. I haven't read it yet because I pre-ordered it and it's on the way. I think it'll be here this week. So I'm really excited to read it. But I think in the book he does talk about, and he compares it to like the space race, all these companies in the clean meat sector trying to produce clean meat as fast as possible and as cheap as possible, just trying to scale it up so that it can be on par with traditional meat in terms of cost. And then, distribution challenges from there. So yeah, it's really exciting. I think we'll have all the answers in that book. And if anyone wants to check it out, cleanmeat.com, you can get your copy there.
That says something too. If there's like, it's not like there's just one company that's done this and wants to, test the market with it. If there's a whole bunch of different companies like fighting to be first, that tells you that this is, when Paul said, maybe this won't even work. Well, when there's that many billionaires that are investing in this, it's going to work.
Yeah, I'm optimistic like as well.
They can't all be wrong.
I think eventually somebody will figure it out. And as far as I understand the problem, I kind of wish I had asked Paul about this, but I think the biggest obstacle is what they call the medium. It's like the liquid that the cells grow in. And that, for whatever reason, is very expensive. So they're trying to find like a cheap version of that secret sauce, whatever you want to call it, to grow the cells as fast as possible and as cheap as possible, but still get meat at the end of the day.
I see. I still have a lot to learn. I got to read this book.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. And then on the 5th, this Friday, he'll be in Toronto, so I'll get to learn more. Maybe we'll do a separate podcast and talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, cool.
So today's current event, did you hear what Forbes magazine put out onto the internet?
Yeah, it was pretty cool to hear that.
Yeah, it says why you should turn your business vegan in 2018. So a great read for the new year and for anyone who currently owns a business or wants to get into a business. It gives so many different positive statistics about the industry and how the vegan industry is growing at this phenomenal rate, way higher than so many different investments. I think what's the standard rate of inflation, 3 or 4%? They're talking about 25% growth in the dairy, plant-based dairy alternatives, 7.6% growth in vegan cheeses, just all kinds of incredible growth stats that show veganism is the future. It's happening right now. And, as Paul mentioned, there's got to be a lot of different options to fix this problem of factory farming. And these are just one. This doesn't talk about clean meat at all. So clean meat is another big business sector that's going to come in and hopefully help solve this problem.
Yeah, and this is Forbes magazine. This isn't like, you know, some whatever blog, and this isn't a pro vegan publication. Like, this is business, and when business is following it, and someone like Forbes is saying, "Hey, you should get in on this now," it's pretty telling. I mean, we're, for whatever reason why it's growing, it is growing, and you know, and society is headed in the right direction. And if it's health, if it's environment, or maybe people are just suddenly listening to their conscience where they never did before. But when Forbes says, "Hey, get in on this now," then it means we're winning.
Yeah, it's definitely not fast enough, of course, for Ben and I. We want it to go super speed, but it's definitely heading in the right direction, which is positive and brings a lot of hope for the future. Hopefully, 2018 will be the year of a lot of successful vegan companies and new people joining veganism.
We're headed there. So it's every year there's more and more. So think about how many vegans you knew when you became vegan, and think about how many vegans you know now.
Yeah, it's great. So, all right. What do you have you got for me today? Something special.
All right. Yeah. I got something special. So for anybody that's just, you know, this is the first time listening, I throw out excuses at Kevin. He doesn't know what they are. And just, you know, excuses that non-vegans would use on why they can't be vegan. So he's been doing too good of a job. So what I did is I asked some people, I said, throw something that you've heard that is just absolutely ridiculous that I can use on the podcast and see how Kevin can handle it. So this isn't going to be your typical, you know, where do you get your protein, or the, you know, the circle of life or whatever. So here we go. You ready for this?
No.
Too bad. So this is what the excuse is. A study was done on inmates in prison that were eating a meatless diet, and they became less violent. Okay, hold on, wait for it.
Okay.
So now, therefore, people in this world are violent, and therefore I want to eat meat to stay on my toes in this cutthroat world.
Okay.
This is an actual excuse. I didn't make this up. Someone is using this logic to, or they're at least pretending they're using this logic to still, you know, take the lives of non-humans.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. So I think what they're saying is they want to be more violent because
yes,
the world
they
is,
need to keep their violence because the world is violent. And if they're not, they'll get left behind or get taken over or killed. I don't know. They need to stay violent to stay on their toes in this cutthroat world.
Well, I guess my response would be, you know, their logic implies that we should all be as violent as we can possibly be, right? that's the opposite of what they're saying, or it is what they're saying. That's the logical conclusion. Let's be more violent because the world is violent, and we need to, I don't know, be more violent to survive, I guess, is the logic. So, all right, let's be realistic. Less violence is a better world, will mean a better world. And I think this speaks so much about what it is we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to create a better world for animals, a less violent world where animals are not tortured, where they're not killed unnecessarily. And who would argue that that isn't a world that they want? You know, everyone wants a more peaceful, less violent world. But I guess it sounds a little bit like the argument for guns, especially in the USA, right? That's where I'm originally from. And everybody wants a gun because the USA is filled with guns. Even though most rational people will say, if, you know, if we got rid of all the guns, or if we had fewer guns, it would be a safer place as far as gun-related violence goes. But because there are so many guns in the world, then I want to have one myself. I think even Bill Maher says that, who is a staunch liberal, like he owns a gun because of that argument. So like I kind of understand where they're coming from, but you know, be the change you wish to see in the world. We want a better world. I think we can all agree that a less violent world is a better world. So therefore, you know, just be that change. Let's embrace nonviolence. Let's not embrace violence.
And you
violence.
Don't need to be violent to survive. Survival has nothing to do with violence. So yeah, this is just, it's silly. So I thought we'd have some fun with it. Also, if this study is true, I've never heard this before, but if this is actually a study, which often it isn't, someone just, you know, makes something up, or someone told them something and they present it as fact. But yeah, if people were eating a meatless diet and they became less violent, then that's a pretty compelling case to eat less meat.
Yeah, I think, sure. Let's feed all the prisoners vegan diets. It'll be healthier for them, better for the environment, better for the animals, and there will be less violence within the prisons. I'm
pretty skeptical that that's an actual study. You know how, you know, someone heard it from someone else, and then they start presenting it as fact, and they'll even say, "Oh, I read a study." Well, really, it was your buddy mentioned it to you one day, and because it fit your agenda, you started using that as fact.
Well, I hope I answered your ridiculous excuse well enough.
You did great. I didn't know where that was going to go. So you actually made that a little more in depth than I was expecting. So I thought you were just going to be like, "No, that's stupid. Move on."
Sometimes I just want to say, I want to give my Obama impression and say, "That's not true," you know, and then just move on. Just that's it. It's not true, but. Yeah, you know what? Those are ridiculous excuses, and they're out there, and people cling to them. So we just got to have patience, right?
Yeah, and we do this for, you know, so people can maybe learn a bit, you know, how to handle these excuses. But then you're always going to get somebody that's just throwing something that's so bizarre and so out there at you that you just have to, you know, be able to reason through it or point out how ridiculous it is and make it clear how ridiculous it is, and that it's not a, you know, viable excuse to, you know, take another being's life.
Awesome. So, speaking of nonviolence, are you ready for the food of the day?
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm on a fast, and you're going to start talking about food. That's all we've been doing today. Okay.
All right, so I went back to the vegetable category because there are so many great veggies out there. So for those listening, I give Ben the food of the day, but first I give him stats and facts about this particular food, and then he tries to guess which food I'm talking about. So this particular vegetable is high in brain-friendly folate, which is iron, and B vitamins. It reduces inflammation. Just one cup of this, steamed, contains more than 65% of your daily value of iron and 20% of your B6. It's also really good for mental focus.
All right, this is a dark green.
Correct.
It's mentioned steamed. I'm going to go with broccoli.
Close. It is definitely green. It's not broccoli.
Asparagus?
If I eat a lot of it, I can kick someone's ass.
Spinach. I was going to say spinach, but who steams spinach?
Oh, sauteed, steamed, raw, whatever you want, right out of the can.
Oh, well, you mentioned steamed. I was thinking like broccoli or asparagus. Okay, spinach. Yeah, that's a good one. It's a superfood.
Definitely a superfood. Awesome. So that wraps up today's episode. Thank you guys for listening. We hope you enjoyed the interview with Paul Shapiro. Again, if you have any other questions, check out his website, cleanmeat.com. And he will be speaking on Friday, the 5th of January, just coming up in a few days in Toronto at the University of Toronto. We will put a link in the description in the show notes for those who are interested in attending. Thank you guys so much. And Ben, don't forget.
Everybody go eat their steamed spinach. That's right. I mean, live vegan.